And we've been talking a bit, weaving through some of the kind of classic or early Buddhist teachings. A couple weeks ago, we had a nice conversation about sex and the challenges of sensuality and desire and this great force that moves around through us and around us. And as we've been doing that, we've been kind of weaving in through what's happening in the world, talking about race and politics a little bit, the various sufferings of this turning world. And so tonight, I want to talk about another one of the five basic ethical teachings, or what are called the precepts in Buddhism. So the precept on wise sexuality is the third. So I'm going to go backwards. I'm doing them out of order, I suppose. And talk about the second tonight, which is conventionally translated as the precept against stealing. The Pali term is adinadana. And I like the translation, not taking that which isn't offered, or which was not given. Not taking that which was not given, which is a little bit more of a direct translation of the Pali. And as we did with the discussion on sexuality, I'll kind of start with kind of what is the sort of old-fashioned teaching, and then we'll open and hopefully touch on both a bit of the personal and a bit of the kind of social communal in relation to this guideline. So sit comfortably, hang out together, shout out questions or disagreement. We'll have time to talk us as well afterward. This precept touches, in a certain way, in a way, all of the precepts touch into all the others. The first of the five traditional precepts is the precept of non-harming, ahimsa, and opens into the others, where this second one, not taking that which isn't offered, in some way touches into non-harming in relation to property, objects, but also our bodies, our energy, our time. All of the precepts, all of the ethical practices are communal, of course, right? Ethics and action are always relational, right? And so, not taking that which wasn't given. On the surface, a kind of most basic way to understand this would be simply to not steal, right? We don't take things, objects, from other people that aren't ours. And in an interesting way, in the kind of Western Buddhist communities that I've been part of, I've often been part of discussions that seem to suggest that this precept we don't have to do much with. That in a way, many of the communities that I've been a part of in Western Buddhism have been relatively privileged. And there's often like this sort of tacit assumption like, well, nobody in here actually steals. So then it's a little bit moot, right? And I mean, and a couple of things. Like, first of all, I think that's probably not true. Like, I hella stole stuff as a teenager, so it's still relevant, even if I'm not actively taking, you know, people's pens and dice and things. I stole a set of Dungeons and Dragons dice from a friend when I was in like seventh grade. I could have gone and bought my own set, and somehow I just like had to take his. And then I lied about it for months. He totally knew it was me, and I was just like, "No, I bought these. They happen to look like yours. I don't know where yours went. You must have lost them." I was totally a jerk. I don't know why it happened in a funny way, except that, you know, craving, fear, all sorts of things came upon me, but for years I was like, why did I do that? Right? And so in a way, right, this precept talks directly to that kind of thing. Like, oh, you just took somebody's stuff. And so, you know, conversations will happen around like the subtleties or the implicit, was it offered, was it not offered? One One student I remember talking about, like, the office supplies at work, you know. It's like, is an extra little, you know, pile of sticky notes, was it offered? You know, I just kind of took some for use at home, some paper, I took some paper clips home, some stickies home. Like, was it offered? I used up 1,000 stickies to make a picture on the window to, you know, something. So that's maybe one place, right? There's a way that there's ambiguities around what was offered or what wasn't offered. The conversation sometimes gets a little subtler and opens into conversations about, like, how we interact with systems. So for myself, I know that one of the times, it's almost like a holiday for this particular precept. One of the times that I worry about this or think about it every single year is when I'm doing my taxes. And like a lot of freelancers, I'm now recording myself saying that for many years, right, there's people give me cash and I don't declare it, right? Somebody's got a recession. And, you know, donations at a sitting group, like, who declares that, right? And in a certain way, and I remember it was maybe a couple of years ago, a couple of election cycles ago, somebody was criticizing somebody else for their tax returns. Some extremely rich man from some corporation, whatever, was being like, you are totally working the tax code. You make gazillions of dollars. You pay hardly any taxes. And his defense was, yes, absolutely, I do everything I can within the law to pay as little as possible. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Like, there was a sense of, like, I'm doing it right. Right? Like, of course I'm trying my damnedest to pay as little as possible. You know, I'm doing everything the law allows me to do, which included, like, tax shelters in the Cayman Islands and, like, all of that stuff, which suggests, you know, a relationship to the law that is, it's like, I'm observing the letter of the law, but not really the spirit of it, right? And so, is it offered? And, you know, for me as a poor freelancer, right, it's like, well, it's explicitly not offered, in fact, right, to not declare income. And then I'm like, well, yeah, but back in the day, there was a whole movement of folks saying, you know, well, 72% of my taxes goes to the military, and I don't believe in that, so I'm going to pay 28% of my bill and just give them send it along with a note that says, I'm withholding 72% of my bill because I'm a conscientious objector to the military. And I tried that one on, but I realized, actually, if I was honest with myself, that's the fourth precept, we'll get there in a few weeks, that I was more concerned with not giving them money than I was concerned with the purity of my anti-military ethic, even though I totally support that anti-military activism. So there's that. There's the, like, how I, you know, take what isn't offered. I believe in the bicyclist's ethic of blowing through stop signs, and it's not offered, right? And on my way here, I blew through a stop sign. Duh. And actually, a sheriff in an SUV turned on their little "I can talk to you from inside the car" robot announcer voice. Oh, no. And didn't stop, but just sort of shouted in my general direction on the street, "Obey the street signs." And I was like Big Brother just, like, happened to say, like, I saw that. And then just drove on, you know. I was like, right? I took something that wasn't offered, perhaps. Perhaps. Definitely. But, you know, in a way that is a little bit also part, it's kind of built in a little bit to the system. So a little bit the paradox here is, like, oh, in believing in this precept, am I setting myself up to actually just sort of, like, nitpick through my life with a fine-tooth comb? And that is a traditional practice, to like go through your actions. Not because the government either deserves your money or your stoppage at stop signs, but because your own freedom from regret and doubt is more important to you, right? This is sort of at the heart of the practice with the precepts traditionally is in part the realization that a huge amount of what we're doing in practice, maybe most, maybe all, is we're setting ourselves up for good mind states in the future. And one of the mind states that's most difficult and painful and specifically precludes meditative concentration is the state of regret. And so, for instance, I regret stealing David Langdon's Dungeons and Dragons dice. Like, it was a dumb thing to do. And he was like 13, the poor kid. Like, geez, his friend stole his dice. That sucks, right? So to the extent that still haunts me, and here I am talking about it 30 years later, it's a wound in my heart that gets in the way of peace. It gets in the way of my own peace of mind, regardless of what I ever even managed to do with him. Maybe I could track him down and try to ask for forgiveness, which is a lovely practice. But part of what's in the texts is that you keep the precepts in part because it's the right thing to do, first of all, and that's mainly that it saves other people from suffering. Like, if I hadn't done it, he wouldn't have suffered. That would be a generous act. And then if I didn't do it, I wouldn't suffer. And there's an attending to the mind states of pain and suffering in both directions. That doing the action is painful, and having the action done to you is painful, and then remembering the action is painful later. So then part of the practice actually is to be impeccable, if you choose to. Again, not, and this one's difficult, I think, for many of us who come from anything like a Judeo-Christian background, or even are immersed in the Judeo-Christian kind of flavored culture, as America is, that there's nothing in here about guilt or judgment, right? Like, nobody is striking me down because I stole David's dice. There's no hell awaiting me, other than the hell of regret, right? Other than the hell of just knowing that I hurt somebody by doing that. That act in the Buddhist kind of understanding is hell, actually, right? That's one very potent way of understanding the many realms and the realms of rebirth. And partly the teaching on rebirth we can understand psychologically in that we take birth in these different kind of mind states moment to moment. And sometimes, based on our actions, we take birth in mind states that are very painful, right? Like the moment when you really connect with something you've done that hurts someone. It's a painful state because you can't get out of it, right? There's a way that, like, it's a realm because you got born there. It's like, ooh, not born like 40 years ago, 50 years ago when you were born, whatever, but like born in this moment, ooh, I did that. And that hurts. And for as long as the, we would say, karma or the effects of that action are ripening in this moment, you exist in that hell realm or that wanting realm or that painful realm. And the way out of any painful realm, of course, is a wholesome action. And the wholesome action is going to be in something like this, right, the turn toward forgiveness. Forgiveness of self, forgiveness of another, asking for forgiveness, which are the three directions of forgiveness practice. The wish for well-being, right, the natural arising of loving kindness, metta, compassion. And in relation to this second precept of not taking that which isn't offered, the wholesome response is also the opposite of the grasping that would lead to this taking in the first place, which is renunciation or letting go, right? Being willing to actually not need to grasp someone else's stuff. So with that psychology at its basis, right? And in a sense, with all the precepts, we're talking about the actions that arise from greed, hatred, and delusion, the three roots of distress or harm. A kind of delusion or grasping or fear leading to needing to have something in a way that is unethical, that may hurt someone else. From there, we can begin to talk really about how we simply exist in the world. So there's the sense of myself, the sense of myself in relationship, both like direct one-on-one relationships and then in communal relationships, to groups of people and then to systems and bodies of people. And in all of that, there's a flow of energy in both directions, right? There's what I receive from others, there's what I give to others, there's what I ask for from others, what I offer to others. And then we can look at this guideline as a way of talking about my relationship to the energy that might come my way or that's out there to be sought after. Right? If we think about it in terms of people, what are the ways that I ask for someone's energy, attention, time, care, love, contact? What are ways that I reach for it? What are ways that I try to have it even when it's not offered? And one of the classic kind of ways that again this precept unfolds in the relational then is in a way opening into the conversation on consent. So how many of us, and this is in this culture largely a gendered question, not entirely, but in many ways, how many of us have been looked at different times on the street or in public in a way that we didn't offer ourselves as the object of that gaze? Or have we, with our own gaze, kind of taken in someone else in a way that wasn't offered to us? And so we can connect in ourselves with a kind of hunger for contact in different ways when we're reaching out for someone. And so part of tracking a vow to keep this precept opens into, I think for many of us, a sense of starting to be more aware of the subtleties of the various boundaries that keep the social realm safe for ourselves and others. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, one of the sutras in the section on these same ethical practices says that the result of keeping these practices, which it calls the great vow of yoga, the keeping of these ethical frameworks, that one of the effects is that you give the gift to other beings of freedom from the feeling of unsafety. So other beings are safe around you when you keep these. And so, you know, when I go into a store and I know that I'm going to respect the store as a thing, right? There's a way that there's an energy of safety around my being there, and I can radiate that to the owners. When I'm in a group of people, to the extent that I know in myself that I'm going to practice strongly respecting others' boundaries, there's the possibility that my presence there will bring a sense of safety rather than a sense of threat. And of course, I want to give the same to others, right? Maybe the flip side of not taking what isn't offered is also how we receive others wanting or not. How we trust is really in here, right? How do we trust others? How do we be trustworthy ourselves with others? So then we begin to tune ourselves to the structures that our social world is made up of. These are the structures of property, in the way that this is a precept about stuff. And, you know, like all structures in some way, many of these, especially because these are social, are somewhat arbitrary, right? The rules of property are arbitrary. You know, we say that I own this nice pink shirt that I'm fond of. But, you know, why do I own it? I own it because I paid $10 for it at Crossroads, you know, and that was a good deal for a nice shirt. But what do I actually own? Like, the labor of the probably, like, kids in Bangladesh that made it? I don't own that. I certainly don't own cotton. We say that I own this amount of cotton that it's made out of, but who gave me the cotton plant? So there's this verse in Genesis at the root, in some ways, of the Christian version of property that says that God gave to man, and I'll keep it in the gendered there, the earth to have dominion over and to kind of, you know, do stuff with, to own in a way. And then all of the suffering that has come out of, in a sense, a disembodied or dis-unearthed something, relationship to that, which could be a very beautiful teaching, right? Because, you know, dominion is just a translation of, you know, an ancient Hebrew word that I don't speak Hebrew, but I imagine that without much creativity, I would be able to translate the word also, for instance, as stewardship, which is a very different word than dominion, right? What if actually God was saying, this is your home, take care of it? And that would be really different. So now, one teacher of mine says, I'll never teach another class without saying the word climate change in the class. So, and I respect that. So right now, my sweetheart and I are with a bunch of other people, because it was too emotionally overwhelming to read alone, are reading Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, which if you really want to cry, but in a very sort of coming out of denial sort of way. Not just about the truth of climate change, which we perhaps know about, but about the relationship of global industrial capitalism to that process. That's the book for that. Speaking of taking that which wasn't offered. And in a way, I trace every piece of property back to a natural resource, right? Who gave us the wood for the floor? You know, well, we bought the labor and all these things, but, like, who gave the trees? It's like, well, at some point, some guys just said, we own this patch of forest. And then, of course, this is a moment to mention the Ohlone and Pomo who live on our coast here, who stewarded, if one could say, or even just lived in harmony with the redwood trees for a very long time. And then almost all of them were cut down in the last 200 years. That's not stewardship, people. That's taking what wasn't offered, I think. So property is embedded in a way with like, what does it mean to own something anyway? Where'd you get it? What is owning? And we all agree, or pretend to agree, on what ownership means. And to a certain extent, that's useful, right? Like, I'm not going to take your jacket or your dice or your whatever anymore, right? Within the somewhat arbitrary boundary system, then, that a social group sets up, there's an ethical practice to both observe those boundaries and sometimes change them, challenge them, or change them if the boundaries themselves are unethical, as I perhaps am implying that the social boundaries around capital and property are, work to change that. But also, you know, don't just put all your money in the Cayman Islands. Like, that's kind of sleazy. If you have that kind of money anyway, like, I don't know, come and talk to me. We'll figure out something better to do with it. Let's, like, buy some land and make a retreat center or something. I don't know. Preserve some forest. But as individuals, our practice then is to just be in relationship to the structures that are around us, right? And not to be deluded about them. To recognize that some of them do protect beings from harm, right? Some of the structures, even if they were rooted in a mistranslation 6,000 years ago, which, you know, many of our structures are, maybe 2,000 years ago, they still serve to protect beings in some way from harm. We can think the same about our relational structures, the social relational structures, which again, in many ways, are arbitrary. You know, they've changed so much over the millennia, which people it's okay to hang out with, right? Several hundred years ago, we would never have had this group as a mixed group. You know, I would be a middle-aged scholar, probably a monastic, teaching a room full of men. And one of y'all women with some experience would be teaching a room full of women. And that's just kind of how it went. Or I would be teaching a room full of women from some distance, you know, through a screen or something. It's happened in some of the old monasteries. So then we have social structures. You know, we have sexist and misogynistic social structures that we can say are unethical. And that at some point were instituted with some idea of protecting beings from harm. Also maintaining other beings' power. And again, structures to be resisted and changed, and also to recognize how we need to work within what exists as we work to change it. And of course, there are structures that that are ambiguously ethical or non-ethical. You know, we have a relationship culture now in the Bay Area that is quite radical compared to much of the world. I have married friends that have multiple lovers and extremely interwoven, kind of, systems that would make my mother just like get very confused, really, as to what on earth we are doing. But there's structures, and you know, the people that I know that work in alternative relationship structures. It's not anarchy. You know, you're like, well, how do you do it? And they're like, oh, well, we do it exactly this way. You know, on Thursdays we do this, this is available, and then other times, you know, one text a month, I do this, they do that, we don't do this with those people. And very, very structured. And it's like, oh, right. So now whatever boundary structure you're in, you then start to discern what does it mean to stay within that structure? Can we make structures in cultures where an amount of freedom is given? Can we make a structure then that takes care of people, you know, that supports well-being? And then, whatever the structure is, what does it mean to take that which wasn't offered to you within a given structure? If at the heart of all of this is a sense that it's possible to live with each other, again, the precept is always relational, it's possible to live with each other in a way where we offer to each other as much as possible for goodness, and then we don't take from each other anything that wasn't offered, what would that look like or feel like for us? As individuals, in one-on-one relationship, in family or group relationships? What would it look like if we could envision cultural boundaries and rules and structures that would actually function that way? That maybe here's a moment to mention the almost like the ghost that makes this precept important, which is like the sense of scarcity. And the wanting or craving that arises in the presence of the experience of scarcity, right? property, like one of the things that's happening in a couple different countries in the world right now, Venezuela in a very, very tragic way, Saudi Arabia in a different and differently destabilizing way, is that oil prices have really fallen. And the absence of oil revenue, which has been the sole sort of source of revenue for some countries, has really destabilized the country, right? Like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was able to put into place what some folks like me would call a the beginnings, at least, of a beautiful socialist state, strong welfare state, real price controls to uplift the poor, a lot of energy put toward uplifting the poor. But it was done with oil revenue, which is okay. You know, I mean, there's oil's a problem. Oil being used to uplift the poor, like, you know, it's a little bit like taking a problem to solve another problem. But it helped for a while. But now prices are falling. That was their only export. And the country is in utter disarray, right? Like starvation war economy. Everything's on the black market. Mafias are buying price-controlled goods cheap and then selling them at highly inflated prices. People are standing in food lines all day and coming home with nothing. So serious crumbling of the social order happening. And partly because, like, the perception of the scarcity of a resource led to a certain price that in some funny way, like, has always been kind of fictional. I remember the arguments in the 70s and 80s with OPEC in the Middle East around, like, well, what do you just, like, you, they just pretend that oil costs a certain thing. And they're like, well, we're just going to pump this much so it costs this much so that everything kind of keeps on being groovy. And the big wars would be like, hey, if we don't like what you're doing, we're just going to pump a little less or pretend we're pumping less or just not sell you from our massive stores of reserves. And the ha-ha, that's going to be bad for you, you know. Like it was always kind of fictional. But there was this play with the perception of scarcity that affected so much. And so, you know, part of this precept, in a way, not taking that which isn't offered, folds into, in a sense, how much do we really need? And the way that as residents of a very, bless you, abundant or greedy, usually those two go together in some way, country, a huge amount of our work right now as a nation or as very privileged people in the world right now is to actually consume less. Right? Back to Naomi Klein and This Changes Everything. Right. I remember maybe a decade ago, one of these, like, you know, what's your global footprint kind of websites showed up, and a bunch of us took a test. Maybe it wasn't that many years ago. It was a bunch, though. And it was something like, you know, it's like, you recycle and you drive a Prius and you do all these good things, but you took one airplane flight this year. And oops, you know, your global footprint just, like, quadrupled. And for everybody on the planet right now to use as much energy as you do would take 9 Earths worth of resources. And that's for, like, and I'm saying you, I mean me, like a super green-oriented, like, kind of socialist hippie who doesn't do much, right, and tries not to fly. But still, you know, the number came out. It was something like, oh, if you take one plane flight, that cancels out all the benefits you got from driving a Prius instead of an SUV. Like, you could have driven a Hummer all year. And one airplane flight across the country does it for, like, your greenhouse gas emissions. But how hard is it to give up flying, given the world what we've created? It's actually not super hard, unless your job really requires it, but that's a sacrifice for many. Right. I have a friend who was really, I don't know many people who would actually really give it up. I knew one guy who was like, I just don't do it. How could you possibly? And he wanted, but he wanted to go to India, so he took a boat. It's very hard to do, actually, right? I know. There's not that many. He had to get a merchant marine license and learn how to, like, you know, fall off a 50-foot diving board and swim, but in order to get that license, so that he could get a berth on a tanker ship going across the ocean, which itself was really ironic that this was like a hyper eco everything hippie from an island off British Columbia, who lives like the lowest footprint life of anyone I could possibly think of. And he's riding like a massive container ship across the ocean. You know, it's like he's hitching a ride on the devil, you know, to get to India. Because that happens to be the most ethical way to get there. Right? So the layers in that are really mysterious. Seriously. What would it mean to not take anything that isn't offered to us? In the realm of property, in the realm of resources, in the realm of relationship. What is being offered to us in each of our situations? I'll end with just the quality of heart that in many ways this practice, this reflection, circles around to. Every time I talk about this, I cringe a little bit. This is like the least popular word in American spiritual practice. It goes against our entire way of life. The word, of course, is renunciation. It's totally central to early Buddhism and the Asian religions. Really, totally central to deep practice in any of the major traditions. And, you know, almost never taught on here. Renunciation is the quality of heart that matures to the point of being done with a certain kind of grasping or consumption, being done with something, not as an act of will, like pushing it away, like, you know, I will not, you know, buy another pint of salted caramel ice cream. But is actual renunciation is actually the, like, I don't need that. I neither need it nor want it. I know what its effect on my body is. One tiny flash of explosive pleasure, and then, you know. I don't need it. I don't really want it. And I don't even want the craving for it. Like, it's not worth that momentary flash of explosive taste pleasure. And you're just like, and for me, renunciation is not even the whole process of resisting it or learning about it. That's the pathway toward renunciation. Renunciation, and probably, again, it's the wrong word, because it's related to the word renounce, which makes it seem like you have to push something away. It's a translation of the word vairagya, which just means vai, the absence of, ragya, grasping. Oh, it's just non-grasping. It's like, oh, I don't need that. That it doesn't pull my heart out of equilibrium when I walk past the shop. Okay, there's a moment where I'm like, And it's like, nah. I remember the moment when I realized that I had been outside of the kind of consumer model for long enough as an adult. I had been just a, like, I never buy anything hippie. I was driving on 101 in San Francisco, that stretch from the bridge as you're going into town, where it's just like these massive billboards on both sides. And it's just like, good stuff, good stuff, good stuff, good stuff. And I remember looking at them and being like, oh, I'm not their target audience anymore. I'm liberated from that. There is nothing in that beautiful Banana Republic ad that is a gorgeous photograph of beautiful people in a lovely place wearing not that many clothing, really, but it's nice clothing. It's like nothing in that is going to make me go into the shop and buy it. Right? It doesn't work on me anymore. I was like, oh, what a good feeling. That was so nice. So nice. I'm like, oh, I'm free from that hooking me. Other things totally hook me, but that one I was free of. I was like, oh, for me, this is renunciation. It's the moment when you get that a thing that could grab your heart, right? You see someone else's thing and you kind of want to take it. You actually no longer want to take it, right? You don't have to resist it. You just don't want to do that. So what would it mean to find that quality in our relationships, in our culture, in our world? What would shift in our communities if we actually valued non-grasping of things, of people, of experiences, of stuff? And then how would that change even the boundaries that we need to set around things, right? Because it's not just that, like, the boundaries are set in stone and so I respond to them by not desiring. But of course, we make boundaries. We make the boundaries in our systems. How would it change our relationships and our communities and our families if the basic ethic was a letting go of grasping? And then from that, boundary simply becomes like what's needed to keep safety here in a kind of, you know, democratically arisen way. So that's a bit of that. Thank you. Pleasure to talk about. Send out into the ethers my apology to David, whose dice I stole. Your thoughts, and just we'll open it up a little bit. What do you think or feel around this area in your practice?
Andy, please. To add to it, I was,
please.
I was just trying to just add more to that, but this whole piece of like interesting relationships, so like rule, like laws and rules and authorities.
Yeah.
Like in a way, it's like almost like don't break. But not quite. And so I guess I thought of this example of like my band was on tour, and we needed a place to sleep for the night. And I'm like, oh, well, like, can't we just, like, find a place, like, in this vast forest and, like, sleep somewhere?
Yeah.
But there was, like, we could not find a place, actually, because, like, it was, like, not allowed. But it's, like, it's just, like, a big forest, like, who owns it? Like,
yeah.
In a way, it's, like, not offered. But not offered, like, by who? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like, interesting blurry areas.
It is. Well, and, you know, it's like, what happens when something should be offered and isn't by an unethical system?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? Like, so many things the law prohibits that are actually total, it shouldn't prohibit, actually, right? Like, it's gone too far in some way. And so... If the thing that matters in the end is mind state, like, are you going to regret having done something? Is it going to haunt you? Because someone was harmed by your doing a thing, you know, then I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, you just find a place to sleep in the forest and it's fine. And, you know, if you do that, but you spend the entire night going, you know, are the rangers going to come and beat us up? Then it wasn't successful, you know, in terms of protecting your mind state.
Yeah. But like an even more heated example that came to mind is like protests and things like that. Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah, for sure.
Where you can be or how you can act in certain spaces.
Right.
Like that, to make point, and so.
Right. Absolutely. And in a way, right, of course, it's necessary to push back against unethical boundaries, right? So I've been arrested a bunch. Like, I've done things that weren't offered. I'm like, oh, the right thing to do right now is to go over there and sit down and do this thing. And it's like, and they're going to be like, we're not offering that you can sit here. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not offering that you go to war. So, you know, there's that. Totally. There's that. Yeah.
I was wondering if you would say a little bit more about the point that you ended on with renunciation and, like, how the other side being some kind of receptivity, or, like, how your thought about how this might shift a set of relationships, how, like, what it means to then receive what is offered.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, before you got to that point about just like how often something, I'm thinking more in a sort of like deeply intimate kind of situation, set of relationships, but like, is something a gift or not? Or is it being, something is clearly being offered, but is it also like, there, is it weighted with some other kind of demand?
Sure, for sure.
And that is paralyzing sometimes, or just confusing.
Yeah. Right. What is actually offer?
But then one response is just say like no thanks all the time, and like really sort of protect from this. The gaze or whatever it is that's being offered.
Yeah.
But then, so then, what is the like? How do we then have then a kind of
nice,
healthy and ethical receptivity?
Yeah. Yeah. I think of a couple of things when you say it. I think it's a great direction to open into. One is that as the receiver, as the recipient, I need to trust the gift. I need to be able to somehow trust what's being offered. When you talk about like being in intimacy, maybe that's part of it for me. I'm like, oh, if there's layers of obligation or hidden agenda, it's not so intimate, right? Or more intimacy is needed. If more intimacy is wanted, there's something to work out there, because in a sense, something seems to be offered, but some aspects of it aren't being offered, right? If there's agenda or grasping. So if the quality of renunciation is kind of interwoven with like acceptance and equanimity, like my practice is to be okay with what's given, you know, like the old monastic practice of just like you go begging and you take whatever gets put in your bowl and you don't complain, right? It's like maybe we eat light today, or it's abundant, and you don't really compare. That for lay people who aren't, you know, living on gift in that way, intimate relationship is a beautiful, charged place to practice that, right? Can I offer as much as possible, as much as I want to offer? Can I receive cleanly what is being offered? Like, almost like, oh, something's being offered to me. What in me is unable to even receive it? Because I'm scared, or I feel defensive, or other things come up. It's almost like I could flip it around and say, if my practice is to not take that which isn't offered to me, and something kind is offered, but I'm afraid of it, it's almost like I'm taking, let me see if I can say this clearly, I'm taking on a certain responsibility or expectation from it that wasn't offered, right? If someone offers me something out of the generosity of their heart, but I'm afraid to take it because I think that there'll be some expectation with it, but I actually don't know if that's the case. I could like take on responsibility or expectation that wasn't offered. Maybe we can interpret this precept as a way of saying, how clean can we relate? How cleanly can we relate in all of the flow between people, right? And that's going to fold into like how clearly we can express ourselves or communicate, say what we need, say what we want, say what we are saying no to. How can we be as clear or transparent about all of those things as possible, so that the gift then gets to be clean, right? Does that touch some of that? Yeah, that's a good direction, I think. Challenging, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have a finger? Is that a finger response? Go for it.
Well, I'm thinking of a response.
Okay. That was just a finger.
That was like, can I say something after you're done?
Oh, yes, please do.
This conversation?
Yes, please do.
I don't want to.
No, we have a few minutes. I want to hear. So go for it.
I don't know. I guess I was experiencing a lot of, like, rage while you were talking. A lot of anger, and like this whole idea of like assuming integrity in an unintegrous world, and like what it actually means to like feel clear of consciousness and not create suffering for yourself and guilt, or like, you know. And I think like Andy kind of touched on it a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, okay, so the point is to have yourself feel not to suffer and not be in hell from things that don't feel clean or in alignment or
right, partly
plague you, but
yeah.
That's not.
Yeah, what do you think? Where should we go with it?
Well, I mean, I think it's just kind of like you can use your internal guide to like, you know, be like, is this the right thing to do or not?
Mm-hmm.
But then you might be like shooting yourself in the foot or ending up in prison or like the world asks of you to do things that are unintegrous constantly, and it's not theirs to give in the first place. It's not theirs to give.
Yeah. Right.
And so it's like it seems, I guess the rage right underneath the rage is just a bunch of grief, you know, around like this seems like an impossible thing to even strive for in today's. It feels like, well, you know, forget it. Like there's just like no way that.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I wipe my butt with toilet paper every day. You know what I'm saying? And where did that toilet paper come? And whose was that to give? And like.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I just feel like. I guess I can just kind of like do my best with like the small things and like start little, but it just doesn't feel like enough.
Mm.
And it's like,
I don't want to
like have integrity to like a government that's like.
Yeah, seriously.
You know, I don't know. I guess I just feel really bummed out and just kind of like. I feel like all I can do is like little tiny things. Like I'm not going to like steal from the people who I nanny for. Like, no, I would never do that. I'm not going to like pocket things from a Target, even though, you know, F Target. I'm still not going to do it because it doesn't feel good for me to do.
Yeah.
And so like I do those things, but still I'm participating and taking things that.
Totally.
Mine are everything I do.
This is totally right on. And it points to, because like practicing the precept isn't useful if it leads us to like hopelessness and despair, right? That's not the point. That can't be the point of the practice. There must be something else. And so what if we, like if we're educated at all about the world, right? We know that that this precept is impossible to keep. Let's just go there. It's impossible, right? Every single action is embedded with harm. And in a very traditional, like the traditional Buddhist response would be like, well, yeah, that's the definition of samsara, right? Like of the sort of endlessness of greed, hatred, and delusion. There's no eliminating that other than by absolute liberation. So we are completely embedded in that. What is possible? And so these things are offered as a practice. And in the Buddhist system, the heart of the practice is around intention. And then we need to take the modern step of there's a whole dialectic right now around like you have to track intention and result, right? It's not enough to just say, oh, I didn't mean to, da-da-da. It's like, well, you didn't mean to, but it had that effect anyway because of systemic yada-yada. So the heart of our practice is still to consistently intend the best and then to respond to what's true. So what does it do? It's almost like the precept just points out to us what the world is like. Like, you say this and I'm like, this is totally true. I also feel layers of rage and despair and grief about this. And actually, like, in my less enlightened moments, which are many, I just feel hopeless, mm-hmm. right? I read Naomi Klein's book and I'm like, capitalism, climate, we're fucked. There's no solution, you know, that's gonna happen. Right? And to the extent that that's true, it's true. To the extent that it's useful or not to emphasize, it may or may not be. But it's very, the Zen people do this more than the early Buddhists. They'll say, like, you know, greed and hatred and delusion are inexhaustible. Nevertheless, I vow to end them. Like, I just take on the impossible,
yeah.
knowing that it's impossible, right? And that perfect action in an imperfect system is impossible. So then what do you do? Where's liberation within that?
Incremental.
Part of it is in the incremental. That's what we can actually do.
Little bits.
And there's a mystical side of the tradition that says that in addition to the incremental, there is something else. And this is kind of the liberation piece, which is that even in the midst of imperfect action, where there's suffering on all sides, there is a freedom of heart possible that does not consist in separation, that doesn't consist in, like, throwing up my hands and leaving, or transcending, or somehow not being a part of things. And yet, it's possible to be liberated of heart within it. And this is a mystery in this tradition. It's one of the things that's in the picture of the six realms, all the hell realms and the heaven realms and all the ways that we can be confused. There's always a little tiny Buddha figure in each one of them. And the image suggests that it's possible to be clear in oneself and engage with a system that's full of suffering in a way where your being brings well-being. And, you know, all of those little bodhisattvas, like, they eat, right, the food that's there. Like, you have to participate to some extent to maintain your well-being in order to serve. And I think maybe that's part of where we're going, right? There's incremental action such that, like, to the best I can, I don't contribute to the worsening situation. And I consume what I need to be able to continue to be a force for good, if I want to be a sort of force for good. And then I try to use my presence here to help. Like, because if the only other option is, like, to disappear, this system says even dying doesn't disappear, you just get reborn somewhere else, and it's the same stuff. There's no escape from it other than engagement. So I'm glad you're saying it, and I'm glad you're feeling in relation to it. I feel as well in relation to it. When I don't feel hopeless, I feel hopeful. And it's hard to even say how different those two things are, because they're very close to each other. So
when I don't feel hopeless, I feel hopeful.
Please.
I think it's really profound. There's, I think, a radical act in the act of giving, which is the other side of this sort of renunciation, I guess. And in a transactional economy where everything's expected to be transactional, when a gift is given, it sort of can, you know, it can be very small, but to create something out of nothing is actually, like, I think at least for me, very hopeful and hope-creating, and sort of has this positive chain.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I hate to say this, but I'll say it. And like Burning Man, for example, an imperfect world, but a different world in which things are less transactional and more gifted, has been a source of hope very much for me. I think specifically in the way it undermines this expectation that to get something, you must give something of equal value according to this system we made up, which doesn't make sense.
To just experience what being in a gift feels like and to see that the
yeah, and are. It's very, like, counterintuitive, because we're talking about scarcity, and so we never want to give in scarcity, but actually the only way
I guess to escape that sense of scarcity is to kind of move into a state of being that is from plentitude, I suppose. And so when I'm feeling most depleted, I find if I just like drag myself into doing one tiny thing, then that like eases it, which doesn't make sense at all. I don't know
you're saying that a solution can be to like create more gifts to give.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
It's beautiful.
It is, and it touches into, and it's our time to close, so we won't go into, global economic systems, but there's often so much more generosity built into communities that are less wealthy, right? The poor give more, right? And there's a sense of being interwoven in a community where, like, if nobody has much money, a lot more sharing happens to keep everybody afloat, you know? One of the things that's most heartbreaking about wealth is that it's isolating, you know? So in this direction, and as you were speaking, I remembered this old book that is beautiful and worth reading by Lewis Hyde called The Erotic Life of Property. It's called The Gift, The Erotic Life of Property. And it talks about gift as profound intimate exchange that subverts everything about scarcity and kind of resource hoarding and isolation and loneliness and separation. And it's beautiful. So it's a good place to end on for the night. Gifting, beautiful gifting. Gifting is actually how the entire system of giving to support monastics has always worked. And we still use the word giving, dana, to refer to, like, you give a bunch of money at the end of the sitting group. It's not a perfect use of that because we're so embedded in the transactional economy that a more appropriate use of it would be to say something like, this group is always free and gifts to support it are always welcome, but not to do it at the end of the sitting group, which can give the impression that giving money is transactional as a response for exactly what happened this evening, right? It's almost like I should say, there's a gifting box out there, like, you know, an impersonal PayPal account somewhere that you can send money to anytime you feel inspired to support, you know, this teaching. And it's not about like, oh, tonight's talk was worth $10, but, you know, sometimes, you know, it's better and I give 20, like, you know, like, it's not that, and it's so hard to escape that, right? So even the system that we do, which is like, yeah, the group is basically free, and giving makes it possible for it to be free, right? And so then there's the possibility for practicing generosity there that we'll do in just a moment. That even that is imperfect because it's embedded in the system in that way. So there's eons, there's layers and layers to practice with there. Thanks for your kind attention and presence and thinking about these things together. It's really a pleasure to come and kind of just each week like open an impossible conversation and be like, how about this? And you're like, oh, that's challenging, you know. And then we'll do another one next week. Maybe next week we'll do speech, right? Speech, words. Ooh. Okay. So, blessings to everyone. Blessings to all beings everywhere. May all beings everywhere be safe from harm and find the deep ease of well-being that is the birthright of all life. So, again, thanks for your generosity. Money that wants to flee from your wallet and go into the sitting group goes in that basket over there. Thank you for that. I'll be here next week and onward. So, blessings. Oh.